CEOs have increased their pay, and yet they don't want to pay what amounts to about a penny a day for 7 sick days for workers. So I'm not happy about that.
Congress shuts down rail workers' labor negotiations. It's Friday, December 2nd, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today, President Biden signed a bill into law that forces freight rail workers to accept a contract with just a single day of paid sick leave, even though some of the workers' unions had rejected the deal. Congress voted to impose the deal anyway at Biden's urging and against the wishes of progressives like Representative Pramila Jayapal, who we heard at the top. They wanted to add 7 days of paid sick leave. Our Friday Politics Roundtable is here to discuss that, and even though the midterm elections aren't fully over, there's still that runoff election in Georgia through Tuesday, there's already news about the primary calendar for the 2024 presidential election. That's where Here and Now's Anthony Brooks and Jane Clayson started their discussion with Rick Klein of ABC and Scott Wong of NBC News.
So, Rick, the Democratic National Committee meeting today and tomorrow to decide which states should vote first in the presidential primaries leading up to the 2024 election. President Biden wants party leaders to make South Carolina the state where the first votes are cast. New Hampshire, Iowa, not happy about that. Biden's plan says after South Carolina, New Hampshire, then Nevada, then Georgia, then Michigan would vote. Why are they doing this?
Well, the DNC knows that it needs to update its primary calendar. They've been talking about this for a long time. Concerns around diversity, concerns around the mess of the Iowa caucuses last time around fueled this. And enter Joe Biden, who hasn't necessarily formally said he's even running for president. He wants to blow up the process by moving the state that saved his candidacy to first in the line in South Carolina and adding big, diverse battlegrounds like Georgia and Michigan at the expense of the Iowa caucuses, which would be jettisoned altogether, and at the expense of the exclusivity that New Hampshire has enjoyed for in the primaries. It's quite a bold move by the White House, by the president, to say directly, this is what I want it to look like. It sure looks like he's rewarding some friends in South Carolina and setting up a system where if he were to face a primary challenger, they'd have a very hard time getting any kind of traction in this kind of environment. So it's not clear the DNC is going to go along with this, but it is quite a big and unexpected move. Even a lot of members of the committee weren't expecting this level of specificity from the president.
So it is a bold move. Scott, is it a done deal? And what's been the reaction?
Well, it's not a done deal, but the reaction on Capitol Hill has been pretty swift. Obviously, if you're somebody from New Hampshire and Iowa, you really don't like this proposal. If you're somebody from Georgia or South Carolina, this is great news. We caught up with Jim Clyburn, the Democrat from South Carolina, earlier today. He's the majority whip of the Democrats. And he says, look, if you look at our state, we have military, we have, business on the coast, we have agriculture, we have diversity of people. He called it a microcosm of the country right there in South Carolina. That is the case that South Carolinians are making for moving them all the way up to the front. But Annie Custer, Democrat from New Hampshire, obviously she said she's very disappointed. She and the delegation from her state have been calling the White House, trying to get them to rethink this decision. And she says that they have to, in New Hampshire, there's a law on the books that essentially makes New Hampshire the first in the nation state in the primary. She says if the DNC shifts them back, they are going to change their primary to move them ahead of South Carolina. So we could see this be litigated in the weeks and months to come.
Yeah, New Hampshire doesn't want to let this one go, that's for sure. Well, let's move on. This morning, President Biden signed into law a rail worker contract that he says prevents a catastrophic railway shutdown during the holiday shipping season, even though it doesn't give workers the paid sick leave that they've been pushing for.
I know this was a tough vote for members of both parties. It was a tough for me, but it was the right thing to do at the moment, to save jobs, to protect millions of working families from harm and disruption, and to keep supply chains stable around the holidays.
Scott, let me stick with you. I mean, the politics here, why did Democrats vote for a deal that some rail unions rejected?
Yeah, this was a really interesting situation. You know, I think everyone on Capitol Hill recognized that the results of a national rail strike, especially right before the holidays, would have been catastrophic. What a lot of the progressives were really pushing for was something that had been left out of this deal negotiated by Biden and the White House. What was left out was paid sick leave as much as 7 days. The current deal that the White House gave unions and labor leaders and the rail companies was just one paid sick day. And many progressives said that simply wasn't enough. So this was an interesting situation and issue where you had the likes of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren on the same side as some really conservative members of Congress like Josh Hawley and Marco Rubio, who were seeing this issue as a way to stand up for workers, but not necessarily support unions. So a very odd situation. In the end, Congress was able to get this to Biden's desk and avert this national rail strike.
Well, to that point, here's Republican Ted Cruz on Fox Business saying the federal government should not bigfoot or override what the workers want.
I don't think that Congress should step in and say it doesn't matter what you workers want. We've decided that the answer is no. I think that's a real mistake.
Well, to Scott's point, Rick, you don't often see Ted Cruz fist bumping Bernie Sanders, at least in public, right? But that happened during a vote to expand sick days for rail workers who say they've been forced to work for weeks straight during a pandemic labor shortage. Where do Republicans fall on this?
Yeah, that's a first. And I think some Republicans saw some political opportunism here to make the point that President Biden, the most pro-labor president in history, he likes to call himself, broke with the unions that rejected these deals. They saw a chance to, as Scott said, to side with workers and union members as opposed to union leaders who had organized this and maybe poke their eyes at poke the president's eye a bit to make this point. I don't think they wanted an actual strike. I think they saw this as kind of a free vote and maybe an opportunity to make a point. People like Senator Rubio have been talking for some time about Republicans becoming more of a working class lunch bucket type of party. Many union members do vote Republican. And here is a stark reminder. This is a bitter pill for unions, but it's a complicated one because, of course, the union leadership did negotiate this deal with at Biden's behest, at Biden's request. And it was some of their own members, not even all of the unions, but some of their members who rejected it and let us into this possibility of a possible national rail strike. So crisis averted, but the politics, I think, will still see some fallout.
Well, on to another big political story this week. House Democrats elected New York Congressman Hakeem Jeffries as their leader. He will replace Nancy Pelosi and serve as minority leader in the next Congress. He becomes the first Black Party leader in either chamber of Congress.
We seek to find common ground whenever and wherever possible. And we hope that our colleagues on the other side of the aisle, as they temporarily inherit the majority in the next Congress, are willing to proceed with that same spirit.
Scott, I'm struck by the way he artfully phrased that our colleagues will temporarily inherit the majority in the next Congress. What kind of leader do you expect Jeffries to be?
Well, he is a tremendous speaker. Somebody just that has a way with words, as you could tell there. He is somebody who has needled Kevin McCarthy and the Republicans for years and years as one of the Democrats' top messengers. And so what you heard there was somebody who's, reaching across the aisle to the Republicans saying, we are willing to work with you, but at the same time, we are also coming for your majority in just 2 years in 2024. And Democrats are right on the cusp of taking back that majority. They just only need to win back a handful of seats and they're right back there. And so Hakeem Jeffries knows that. And being in the minority, he's going to be very strategic in the Democrats' messaging in trying to undermine the Republicans and portray them as a party in chaos.
Mm-hmm. Okay, quickly before we go, a setback for former President Donald Trump this week in the investigation of classified documents seized at his Florida estate, Mar-a-Lago, after he left the White House. An appeals court yesterday struck down the special master that's been deciding if some of the records should be kept from Justice Department investigators. Rick Klein, what's likely to be the mood in Trump world right now? What does this mean for him?
legal setback after legal setback, and there have been so many of them. And this issue, which is not a narrow one, it's a pretty significant one. I think it's widely expected that a special master would go away in accordance with other rulings. But it would seem to increase the potential pace. Now, we know there's a special counsel that's been named by the Attorney General. There are so many multiple investigations going in so many directions of this act of candidacy for president. There is a sense, they've been there before, where the walls start to close in. I think it's a familiar sense in Trump world, but this is clearly not good news for any efforts to try to keep this investigation at bay.
Scott, you get the last word in 10 seconds.
Yeah, for a presidential campaign rollout, this has certainly not been a smooth one for former President Trump, given some of these court decisions as well as the controversy that he is embroiled in after having dinner with the white nationalist Nick Fuentes. And so this has been a pretty disastrous couple weeks for the former president right after he announced his bid for returning to the White House.
Scott Wong, senior congressional reporter for NBC News. Rick Klein, ABC News political director. Always great to have you both on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
By the way, on the topic of that rail worker fight for sick pay, we want to hear from you if you also don't have time off for illness. Send us a short voice memo or an email to letters@hereandnow.org, or just head over to hereandnow.org and scroll down until you see the fight for paid sick leave. Tell us your story. We might put you on the show. After the break, Cleveland Browns quarterback Deshaun Watson is expected to start on Sunday for the first time in nearly 2 years amid dozens of allegations of sexual assault. Stick around. Deshaun Watson's 11-game suspension is ending, far too soon, according to advocates for the many people who've accused him of sexual assault. Watson has settled almost all of the 24 lawsuits he faced from massage therapists who claim he abused them during therapy sessions. Lindsay Jones is here to help us understand what to make of his return. She's The Ringer's senior NFL editor, and she spoke to Jane Clayson.
Remind us briefly, what is Watson alleged to have done, and when did he do it?
Well, more than 24 women have accused him of basically the same thing in a series of civil lawsuits, which, as you mentioned, nearly all of them have been settled. But almost all of the allegations are similar in nature, in that he turned massage sessions, into sexual situations with unwanted sexual advances, things from, you know, touching, groping to some accusations of sexual assault. So, you know, it was all very roughly the same thing stemming from these massage sessions, mostly occurring late 2019 into 2020.
And throughout this whole thing, Watson and his team have publicly maintained his innocence in spite of those settlements with 23 women. Here is Watson speaking to the media back in August.
I've always stood on my innocence and always said that I've never assaulted anyone or disrespected anyone, and I'm continuing to stand on that. But at the same time, I have to continue to push forward with my life and my career.
He certainly is pushing forward with his career. The Cleveland Browns signed Watson to a 5-year, $230 million fully guaranteed contract. Knowing all this, how have the Browns owners and management addressed this?
Well, they've been very vague about it. And the one of the most challenging things, I think, to reconcile, especially now that Deshaun Watson is going to be playing football, is that, you know, these allegations were very credible. No, there were no criminal charges filed. Two grand juries in Texas declined to pursue criminal charges. But the NFL's investigators and the neutral arbiter who is appointed by the NFL and the NFLPA, you know, found the cases that were presented before her in their investigation to be true, and that more likely than not, he committed sexual assault. So the Browns have moved forward, you know, giving Deshaun Watson one of the largest contracts in NFL history,
yeah,
knowing that this stuff is out there. And they seem to be fine with it. I mean, the things that you hear coming from the team is that he has been a good teammate, he's great in the locker room, and he's been keeping his body in shape and is ready to play. And, you know, I know for a lot of, you know, sexual assault survivors, and actually about 10 of the women who, you know, accused Deshaun Watson of these crimes, they'll be at that game in Houston. Mm-hmm. Of course, this game is in Houston because, of course, it will be. So that's, I think, the most difficult part of this for everybody to kind of reconcile.
What about the league? 11 games seems like a very light punishment for what he is alleged to have done. I mean, players have had longer suspensions for recreational drug use and sports betting. Is the NFL really taking these accusations seriously?
Yeah, and that's where it gets really hard to play kind of the apples to oranges games for all of the various parts of the personal conduct policy. Ultimately, this 11 games was the result of a settlement between the league and the NFL Players Association and Deshaun Watson's team. The initial punishment recommendation that came from this arbiter, Judge Sue L. Robinson, was 6 games. The NFL had the ability to appeal. They had that power under the collective bargaining agreement. And they pushed for a full year suspension. That's what they were pushing for from the beginning, where it would be 17 games with requirements that Deshaun would have to meet along the way to be reinstated. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, they reached this settlement, which is kind of halfway between Judge Robinson's initial recommendation and that full season. So it is a more severe punishment than other players have received for these personal conduct violations. But as you mentioned, not as severe as, you know, there was a player from the Atlanta Falcons who is serving a year-long suspension for, as you mentioned, sports betting. So right. It is a little incongruous. They, you know, the NFL has a not great history and track record with how seriously it takes crimes against women and accusations of violence against women. In this case, they did push for more severe punishment, but then ultimately the lawyers got involved and they ended up with this settlement.
So Watson faced the media for the first time in 4 months yesterday. Here he is with an opening statement and saying what he would and would not talk about.
You guys have, you know, a lot of questions, but with my legal team and my clinical team, there's only football questions that I can really address at this time.
So he's back with his first game with the Houston Texans. Most of the allegations date from the time he was playing with the Texans. Got about 10 seconds here. What kind of reception do you think he's going to get on Sunday?
I don't think it'll be great. I mean, he was unhappy. He forced his way out of Houston. I know there, you know, his first game he played, his only game in the preseason in Jacksonville, very hostile reception. So I expect it'll be a very angry crowd.
We'll be watching. That's Lindsay Jones, The Ringer's senior NFL editor. Lindsay, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up next, need a new book? The host of NPR's Book of the Day podcast stops by with some reading recommendations. That's after the break.
Well, let's take a moment now to talk about books. In the past 10 years, NPR has helped readers with Books We Love, a curated collection of titles recommended by NPR staff and trusted critics. In that decade, they've suggested over 3,200 titles. And just in time for the holidays, Books We Love has been updated. And here to tell us about it is Andrew Limbong, host of NPR's Book of the Day podcast. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Jane.
So remind us, how does the NPR Books We Love site really work?
All right. So like every year around the fall, we reach out to a bunch of like writers and critics and NPR staff asking what their favorite reads of the year were. And then our books team sort of like compiles all of that information and curates it into this like giant compendium of all the books that we loved this year. I think like we've literally got more than 400 books this go around. And if that sounds like big, we've got some filters that you can use to narrow down your search. So you can sort by like book club ideas or staff picks or identity and culture or, you know, all three of those.
So, all right, then what happens when you use those three filters, right?
Yeah, right. So if we go along with it and pick those three, you get like a handful of books. And so like among them, there are actually two that I thought posed some like thought-provoking questions on a similar topic. One is by Angela Garbus. It's called Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change. And the book shows that mothering is a job, you know, one that we as a culture underappreciate and most definitely like underpay, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, especially in light of the pandemic, if you look at who had to leave their jobs to do the work of like taking care of the kids and taking care of the house and be an IT professional to figure out how to do online schooling, you know, it was mostly women. And I think, you know, it's interesting to think about that book alongside another nonfiction book that Books We Love recommends called Bad Sex, Truth, Pleasure, and an Unfinished Revolution by Nona Willis Aronowitz. This book is like, it's part memoir, talking about how she left her husband, partly due to the sometimes mediocre and sometimes like bad sex they were having. And it's also partly an inquiry into how like culture shapes desire. This book was actually an NPR staff pick by one of our publicists, Emma Gordon, and she wrote that this spirited history paints feminism not as a fixed set of past and beliefs, but as an invitation to question the status quo.
Hmm. All right. Well, it's gift-giving season, so give us some recommendations here for the readers on our gift list.
Yeah, TikTok, right? We're all up against the clock here, yeah.
Yes.
So there are actually a couple of books for, you know, the hardcore book lovers out there. One of them is an essay collection called How to Read Now by Elaine Castillo. It's a critical examination of the role we play as readers in engaging with a text. And I'm using the word text there kind of broadly because the book focuses on books, but also, you know, touches on movies and TV. And it's like a reminder to just be aware of the baggage that we might carry when we consume art, you know? Hmm. If that sounds a little like too heady, you know, a little too like, yes, reading. there's also this book by Annette Dauphin-Simon titled Spine Poems, an Eclectic Collection of Found Verse for Book Lovers.
Huh.
So just like imagine looking at your shelf or like the stack of books on your nightstand table and reading those titles as a poem. This book is literally a collection of poetry from book titles, so it looks exactly like that. And some of them end up as, like, interesting social commentary, and the other just, like, sort of cutesy imagistic poetry. And real quick, for any like, romance people out there, there's a novel by Alexa Martin titled Better Than Fiction. It's about a woman who, you know, she isn't much of a reader or, like, a book person, but then she inherits her grandma's bookstore, and one day a famous romance author comes to town and, you know, does a reading at her store, and, you know, you can guess what sort of happens
at the end of that
there.
Story. Yes, sure. All yeah. right, we're running out of time, but I've got to get this in. What were some of your favorite reads of the year, you, Andrew?
All right, yeah, one of the books I blurbed is titled Luda. It's by Grant Morrison. Now, Morrison's best known as a comic book writer. You know, they've written some great X-Men books, some great Superman books, but this is their first novel. It's about an aging drag artist named Lucy LeBang, who, you know, is kind of washed, but they're part of this, like, pantomime group putting on this, like, buzzy show. Then, like, a younger drag artist comes onto the scene named Luda, who seduces her way into becoming Lucy's protege. And, you know, everything's great until bad things mysteriously start to happen to the other cast members. it's a fun read that has all these, like, twists and turns, and it's, like, a little hard to keep track of what exactly is going on,
yeah.
you know, but Morrison's writing is fun enough to keep you reading.
Okay, I've got 10 seconds. What's your personal number one reading list favorite from Books We Love?
All right, on my list right now that I want to buy, it was recommended by my colleague Sydney Madden. It's called Shine Bright, A Personal History of Black Women in Pop by Danielle Smith. It's just this contextualization of like these huge pop figures in music, you know, your Gladys Knights and Aretha Franklin's, and really gives them their due in the pop music canon.
That's NPR's Books We Love with the Book of the Day podcast host Andrew Limbaum. I've been taking furious notes, but if you haven't, right. go to our website, hearnot.org. We've got it all there. Andrew, thank you so much.
Cool. Thank you, Jane.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Check out our website, hearandnow.org, for more stories, including a look at misinformation online in Spanish.
There's just so much more. And some of that is because Latinos spend twice as much time on YouTube as other non-Latino adults. They use YouTube, as an example, as their primary source for news and information.
We're glad to be a source of information for you, and a reputable one at that, we hope. So thanks for listening. If you missed any of this week's episodes, scroll back in the feed for stories about young women of color smashing the stigma of living with HIV, or whether virtual reality gaming is really poised to take off. We've got stories on the volcanic eruption in Hawaii, the protests in China, and so much more at hearandnow.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you've been hearing, make sure you subscribe, tell a friend, and rate us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And thanks. Today's stories were produced by Lynn Menegon, Thomas Danielian, and Emiko Tamagawa. Todd Munt and Gabe Bullard edited the show. Technical direction today from Max Liebman and Mike Moschetto. Theme music by Max, Mike, and me. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. The executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, everybody.